If you love a prodigal, you can discover help and hope for your wilderness journey right here at When You Love a Prodigal, and also help and hope for your own life journey. My special guest today, Margaret Philbrick, will take us on an intriguing journey through an unusual approach to loving our prodigals. I think you're going to really enjoy her and what she's going to share. I first met Margaret as we were both members of the Redbud Writers Guild, and I still remember my amazement at her first novel that I read called A Minor, A Novel of Love, Music, and Memory. I have no musical ability, but her story fascinated me. And today we are talking about art, another topic I know little about, but Margaret does, and she will take us on an introduction to Henry Nouwen's book, The Return of the Prodigal Son, which is a reflection on Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son. And I know both of those, so this is that part is familiar. But then she's going to take us on an adventure and some intrigue in Italy. And I've been there, but not all the places she talks about. I want you to hear what my endorsement for her book is. Her book is launching today.
Woo!
And we're very excited about this. And she gave me the privilege of writing an endorsement for her book, which is entitled House of Honor, The Heist of Caravaggio's Nativity. And I just am so excited for her. So here is my endorsement. I've rarely read a long book in one sitting, but I did with Margaret Philbrick's House of Honor. My memories of Italy were refreshed with vivid descriptions and fascinating characters. Entering the world of art and meeting Caravaggio captivated me. Intriguing tales of Cosenotra and the Vatican were also keeping me reading. And most of all, the heart of this prodigal mama was both broken and hopeful. A wonderful book.
Thank you, Julie.
So glad to have been able to do that. So, Margaret, let's start at the beginning, kind of. Where did this idea come from?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. Such a delight on a day of launching after 9 years of working on this book to sit down with an old friend like you and talk about this. The idea came from a trip in 2015 when we were walking between the Trevi Fountain and Piazza Navona. And my youngest son, Nathaniel, said, "Mama, you have to come into this church, which is San Luigi dei Francesi." And he said, "There are three Caravaggios in here." And my mother was an oil painter. I grew up with a lot of art speak and art life. And so I said, "Let's go." And when we went in, there was a priest from the Vatican giving a lecture in Italian about the paintings. And he kept putting a coin in the metal box to turn on a single light to illuminate partially these paintings. And I mean, it was just such a low-tech approach to Caravaggio. And I mean, we had to stay there quite a while to actually even see the paintings. And I was very moved, kind of taken apart. I think this happens with Caravaggio's art, where people connect to it so deeply in the heart for a lot of reasons that they have a feeling of being kind of unbound and laid out by it. And then they sort of sit with it and see, what is God doing right now? What is happening with me? And that set me on a journey. I did not intend to write the book when I saw the paintings at all. I just wanted to understand who the artist was and what was going on with his art and why was it affecting me like that. So I went on a journey of very significant research for 3 years about his art and his life. And then that revealed to me that one of his paintings of the Nativity was taken in 1969. It was cut out of the frame with a box cutter in Palermo, Italy, and it has never been recovered. And so this question of who did it, why would they do that? Why would you take a masterpiece like that in such a brash, just awful, just corrupt way? And then now it's lost to us. I just couldn't stand it. It's its own prodigal story, really, the painting is. And we're all still praying for it to be revealed and to be returned. So that just really got me. I was like, I have to write this now. I have all the research. I have the motivation for the story, which is, what do you think happened to this painting and why did somebody take it? And so that's what set me on the path.
Oh, wow. Well, here's a thought. Maybe your book will be the impetus, the way that this is found, because some people will read and maybe come forward with what they know.
I would love it. I hope the book touches the people who know what happened to it in that kind of way, that they would realize that, the world needs the painting more than they need the painting hidden under, a bed or in an attic somewhere.
So,
I do think the painting is definitely still in existence. I really do. So yeah, I think that would be great. My husband has a theory that Stephen Zelane, who created the Ripley series, which has just run on Netflix, he thinks that they're going to do, the further series after it, and that indeed it is going to be a part of it, this heist, and that they're going to
wow.
tell their story of Thomas Ripley stealing this painting. This is his idea. I mean, who knows, but it's pretty funny. Yeah. So at least if it gets people talking, that's interesting.
That will be interesting. So, where does Caravaggio come into the things that you've also said about Rembrandt's painting and Henry Nouwen's book on the return of the prodigal? How does this connect?
Well, Caravaggio himself was such a prodigal. He lost almost all of his male relatives to the Black Plague. And his mother sent him away from Bergamo, from northern Italy, to be basically protected and apprentice in a studio when he was very young, hoping that he would not die and he would not get it. And he did survive. He spent a lot of time painting salad in a bowl, which he did not like. And so he went on his own journey. He did not go back home. He, very, at a very young age, 17, 18, went to Rome and set out to make a name for himself in art. And that was a short journey. He only lived into his early 30s, but he was just bound and determined to carve and cut his path apart from his home. And his homeland in art. And so he did a lot of terrible things along the way. He's known as the bad boy of the Renaissance art world for many good reasons. And as a result, he himself really is a prodigal. And the ending of his life and the ending of his story is so tragic. And I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give the whole book away.
Right, I don't want you to.
Yes, right. But he and because he, I love his art so much, and I was so impacted by his own story. And I do say in the book, we're all prodigals. All of us are.
We are, and I say that often.
Yes, and so I developed such a heart to pray for the soul of Caravaggio, because his art is still reaching and touching just masses of people, and including myself. So, just praying for God's mercy for him. And then Rembrandt himself also had this crazy life where he became famous young, and he kind of lived the wild hellion life, and then just started losing everything. He lost everything. He lost all his family. His children died. He was bankrupt. I mean, only one child outlived him by his second wife. So he has a very similar story. The wild, giving yourself over to wild and lascivious living. And unlike Caravaggio, he lived long enough at the end of his life to paint this painting of the prodigal son. And Nouwen had the same experience with this painting, similar, I should say, to what I was experiencing in the Controlli Chapel, where you're sort of being taken apart by an image and you're wondering what God is doing with it. And then so Nouwen prayed about it, thought about it, changed his life completely over the painting. And that's why we have this book, The Return of the Prodigal Son by Henry Nouwen. And that was the first theological text that I read as research. Once I moved beyond the art, then I really had to get into the mafia, the Vatican, the theology behind this art and why people were painting in it, what they were hoping to communicate by it. And then how was Nouwen moved by it? And I picked his book first because of the image itself, because I love Nouwen's writing, as
I
well
do
as,
too.
yeah, I just love him. I mean, how can you not love him? Right? He's so
Well, that
Christ-like.
he's so Christ-like, the choices that he made to what to do with his life in the latter part was just beautiful.
Yeah, and so Rembrandt, in doing and creating this painting, in many ways was doing the same thing. And I think that Nouwen saw that in the painting, that this is a person who is depicting this return of the lost son, with so much illumination and power and then theological import, that he had to take it apart and he had to then pray through it and see what God had in revealing it to him. So I love this painting and this text, because for Caravaggio, it's kind of like an unfinished story. Only the Lord knows what's going to ultimately eternally happen to him. Whereas with Nouwen, he gave us this painting right at the end of his life. And so we have a sense of where his own heart was. And we just don't have that with Caravaggio. So his last paintings are so sad and dark. And the martyrdom of Saint Ursula is on display in the National Gallery in London right now. And there's just a lot of conversation right now about how his art in such a short time evolved between 18 and, his early 30s. It's just a very dramatic change in the color and the lively nature of the naturalism of what he was depicting.
Rembrandt and Caravaggio had a place to really come for transformation. They both came from a hard background and bad things, and God, well, not with Caravaggio as much, but with Rembrandt, restored his relationship with God, which is at least evident in that painting, which is a powerful painting. But Nouwen, on the other hand, may have been struggling in his relationship with God and walking, but he was not a prodigal in the traditional sense.
Not at all. I mean, he tells you in the book he had this just privileged Christian life. All he was the good boy. He was the altar boy. I mean, he had all the great teaching. He was prayerful. He knew he wanted to be a priest from a very young age. I mean, he was in the faith as a
Yes.
foundation. And so then, he lives in this world of academia for quite some time later
Yes.
and starts being kind of like thrown about and thinking, what is my foundation that I'm treading on? And the painting, when he was sitting in his friend's office and he saw the poster, he started thinking, who am I? Who am I? Who am I in this painting? And that's really a question everyone is always asking, right? Not maybe it's not art, but who am I and what am I doing here?
Yes.
And I
Most
think that he,
people, I think, get there.
yes, I hope so.
Yes, I
Yeah, I
do
hope
too.
so. Yeah. Yeah.
So you quote it, and I will repeat that we are all prodigals, and according to Nouwen, trying to find our way home. How do you see that these three amazing people, Nouwen and Caravaggio and Rembrandt, how they experience that reality in their own prodigalness or not?
I think, with Nouwen, I would say, based on the book, it's a pretty heady exploration, which he takes to the Lord and starts thinking through, am I the younger son? Am I the elder son? Am I the bystander? And he decides, I'm actually all of those things. And then he really comes into a bigger revelation of, I'm called to be the father. I am. So he has that, a holistic experience of the painting where he sees in it all these things. It's kind of like, God is, I am. He's all of it. I am
Yes.
everything. And I can be everything for you. And he recognizes, but I can't be the father. I'm not the father. And the Lord is saying to him, well, yeah, you actually have within yourself the ability to surrender to that degree that I am everything. And so he is really treading that line, which is, kind of like the
Right.
ultimate or penultimate line before we're in his presence, right? Whereas Caravaggio, he is trying to become famous in the eyes of the world. I mean, he's got the swagger, he's got the brashness, he's got the sword and the golden chain, and he's going to show everyone
And
that,
that was very evident in your book.
Oh,
So look
good.
forward to it when you read it.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, he's like, I'm doing Instagram. I'm gonna be someone, and I'm gonna let you know it. And so he kind of is treading the opposite line, which is I want to have all eyes on me. I want all popes to come and genuflect at my work. And so they're kind of these opposing diameters, right? Or perspectives on prodigal nature, where one is, now one is reconciled to the fact that I have to move forward in who I am as God's, creation. And he is saying, you have to move toward me because I am showing you God's creation. So that's part of the engagement, I think, of this comparison is how far opposed these two lines are. And then Rembrandt is artistically, like I said before, really at I think he died, he was 63 or 60, yeah, 65. He's at the end of his life, basically bankrupt. And he knows that he has just who he has been made to be as an artist, and he has to give that over to the Lord. And Nouwen tells us in the painting that even the hands of the Father are representative of one male hand and then a female hand, so that that Father is embodying all of the masculine and all of the feminine in the way he's being that love persona for everyone. And I've never even noticed that in the painting
Well, I have
until.
never noticed that either,
Yeah,
so thank you.
isn't that neat? I know. It's the all-encompassing love of God that he felt, Nouwen felt, that Rembrandt really captured, which to him showed he has come quite a long way in his journey of prodigalness, right?
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So do you think, well, I think you've just explained the whole we are all prodigals in a sense, and they represent three kind of levels of that or places in life where they're going to come from a really, really struggling in a hard place and a very prodigal life, and one of making the discoveries, and then one of at a place where they can really see the what role God plays in their lives. And that's a hopeful thing because people who love a prodigal, as you know, and as I know, it's a place where often hope disappears. And because there's nothing that's giving us the evidence that something could change, that this life will be restored or redeemed. And so these pictures are beautiful to say, okay, there's often a path. So here's a question I have for you. How have you experienced, as you've been writing this and reading and living with prodigal, how have you experienced your own, we are all prodigals?
That's such a good question. I think so. I have this challenge, and I think a lot of writers do. Judy, I know, I'm sure you do too. Here we are on a podcast and we're talking about this. And I would rather not be talking about it. I would rather just release this book into the world and let it
Yes.
just live its own entire life and never touch it, never Instagram about it, not talk about it. And so, because of the culture that we're in, we've kind of become this technological slave. There's like an enslavement that if you want anyone to care about this, you darn well better be talking about it and putting it out there. And so, I think that, and I have this real, I've never had an iPhone. I've written about that, why I've never had one and never wanted one, which messed us up today because we couldn't do this on the phone. Sorry, because that was annoying. But I do think that there is a sort of like a technological bankruptcy that is contributing to my own sort of prodigal emptiness because it's so quick and easy and candy to replace what would be spiritual time communing with God with just making a text or having a post on Instagram or scrolling. And so it's just like, I feel like it's just bankrupting our souls in with such a depth and my own that I am constantly fighting against it. And so that's tiring, right? It's not
Yes.
restorative. It doesn't, like the Lord can, come to us in the quiet. And when we listen for his little quiet, small voice speaking, we get filled up. Well, the opposite of that is the clamor. And I feel like this technological authorship over life today is very bankrupting of the soul. So I'm fighting against technological prodigalness, honestly, as this book is launching. That's why it's very germane right now, I would say.
Oh, that's so true. and I've just been with my grandchildren, two sets of them. I still have another set of them, but I've been with two of them. And to see them with their screens in front of them, and their parents in both cases are pretty strict on it. And so they're not like a lot of kids that just that's where they spend their life. But it's very that's what they think's gonna make them happy. And so it doesn't give them the hunger that often is what causes you to first see your prodigalness, but also to see and have hope for a different life. And so I think what you've just said is a good thing for us to think about, that our culture today is contributing to a desire or a pursuit of what is not really going to satisfy.
And so you end
And
up with like a corporate prodigal nature.
yes.
And that's kind of shocking, right? I mean, we've never really lived in a space where we are all prodigals because we all walk with our heads down and just are staring at a phone and no one else. I mean, that's just a contributor.
So let me ask this question. How does this prodigal reality that we've been looking at play into the story of your book without giving too much away?
So I wanted this to be, a tale of two sons from two different, very different families, and their relatives kind of are involved as well. But it's really about this boy, who at the time is a boy, Orazio Bordoni, in the north, and he lives in the same area of Italy where Caravaggio grew up. And just people, some people know the last name of Caravaggio, that's the name of the town that he lived in. So his name is Michelangelo de Merisi, but then it's de Caravaggio because that's where he lived. So that's how we
Okay,
know him.
that's
Yeah,
good to
that's
know.
kind of fun to know. And then Niccolò Jaddo is from Sicily, and he is the heir apparent to a very powerful mafia family. And his father has all the best intentions for kind of keeping him pure and out of the slime of the family's entanglements with that which is illicit and awful. So he's protected him to keep him sort of a good boy, but ultimately manage the family affairs in an honorable manner. So his father has controlled his whole life. And now he's come of age to really become the heir apparent and live into that role. And so these two sons basically are taking on their adult manhood in contrasting ways. Orazio asks his father in the beginning of the book for his inheritance, and he refuses to take over the company, which has made his family very wealthy. He resents the fact that his dad has spent his whole life doing this and wants nothing to do with it. And Niccolo respects his father greatly. He's suspect of really what all is he involved in, but he also knows he's doing a lot of good in Palermo and for Sicily. And so the two of them set off on these prodigal life journeys within the context of their role and their appropriate role in their own families. And they meet, these two stories of these men, developing men, meet in Rome in a church when Orazio is in there with his brother Vincenzo, who is a priest in the Vatican, and he sees this man who he thinks he knows from his father's company. He thinks that Niccolo worked there and he recognizes him. And it's the Feast of Saint Joseph, and he watches this very handsome Sicilian go up to the altar at the feast and pick up a lemon off of the altar and throw it up in the air in this rather brash technique that most people wouldn't do in a church. And he finds that hilarious because Orazio is this iconoclast and really kind of admires the fact that this unknown person who's Nico would actually do that. And so they are, prodigals in the sense of the way they are relating to their families, one departing, one desiring to honor the family, and then how those stories entwine and ultimately entangle the two of them, as well as the family's enterprises.
And it's a fascinating story. If you will, and I hope you will read this book, you will not only be fascinated by the stories of people and the development of the characters, but just to understand some of the realities of the past and where they were at least a few decades ago when the story takes place. And it's just a fabulous story. I'm
Thank
grateful.
you.
I'm grateful that you wrote it and that I got to read it for them. Let me ask you, what's your hoped for outcome for this book, other than that you sell a lot of books and become a famous author and all of that.
I'll tell you what, this is really true. I am of the age now, and as a writer, I'm kind of over the sort of success quest, the Caravaggio, I'm going to be famous thing. That is definitely not what it's about. And I learned this in part from Charlie Peacock and his wife. I was on a call with them, a Zoom call with a lit group that I'm with, and they had just had a book come out this year in March, and they were asked that question. And they said, they're older than me, but they said, we are no longer praying for success. We're praying for fruitfulness. And
Absolutely.
yeah, and I love that. I think that with this book, to have people, I say in the end, in the behind the book section, stand in front of great art, to enter into a museum, to leave their phones behind and go and stand in the presence of a real living piece of art, and really ponder it and take it into their own hearts. And let it impact them in a way that reveals more of who they are as they relate to God. That would certainly be a huge goal, is to kind of get people more into the real world and away from scrolling, and believe that, God gives us art, because it changes the world. I mean, and it endures. We're talking about Caravaggio 450 years later. I mean, these are things that are
And people
living.
talk about him all the time now.
I know.
Having read your book, I
Yeah.
notice that he's
Yes.
very much in discussion now.
Yeah, he's hot right now. I mean, he's kind of experiencing a bit of a resurgence thanks to Stevens Lane and Ripley. I mean, and a lot of other things. I mean, the painting and Madrid being authenticated as a Caravaggio. There's a lot of things happening right now. But I say, so I think that that's a big idea. A big fruitfulness is just a return to art, whatever the art form is, as a way of having our souls impacted in the goodness of God. And then I would say, certainly understanding the torment of someone like Caravaggio and so many artists, and
Yes.
really just valuing what they gave to us despite who they were, and then thereby connecting with people's brokenness and just recognizing that so much beauty is coming to us out of so much deep brokenness, and that thereby valuing people as creature creators much more than otherwise we, that we would. And just scrolling away and being so distant and separated from the humanity of what it is to create art and who those artists are. I mean, that kind of separation is akin to separation from God to me. And I don't want people to live like that. I want them to enter in, right, to that goodness. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that the story of Caravaggio is that his paintings had the message. His paintings showed the realities and the possibilities in a relationship with God. And yet he could paint it, but he couldn't find it.
Yeah, he was the bystanders on the right-hand side of Rembrandt's painting. He depicted himself as such in his own art. So in the Taking of the Christ painting, he's on the farthest outside, right edge, but he's holding a lantern so that you, because of the light he's shining on the scene, can see the scene that he has painted better. So he is, in a way, depicting himself as the suffering servant, like the David and Goliath painting. That's a self-portrait of him hanging there with just the guts dripping out of his neck,
Yes.
but also as the light bearer. And I think that he was really thinking about these things. This is who we are. And because he was so dedicated to this just extreme naturalism in his depiction of humanity, he's doing it with himself. He's sitting there and saying, I
Yes.
am this. I am Goliath, but I'm also bringing this light to the scene of the taking of the Christ. And thereby, he's saying, isn't that just all of us? Isn't that who we are?
That's, yeah, so good. Margaret, thank you. Thank you for chatting with me. Thank you for writing this book, doing the years of research that it took. I'm just really thrilled, and I'm praying that God will use it in a lot of ways, but I want to especially hope that it speaks to the audience that listens frequently to this podcast and gives them a different perspective and helps them open their minds to other ways that God will speak to them as well as to their prodigals, and that it will even help make a bridge to them, that there can be return and restoration, even as Rembrandt portrays. And so thank you for that. And I want you to I'm going to give away a couple of copies of your book, and we'll have a drawing. And so, for my listeners, you go to the show notes and sign up if you want to be in the drawing. And I also would really encourage you to take some time to think about what Margaret has shared with us and see if God has a message for you that will give you help as you seek, desire, pray for, hope for a restoration and a change for your prodigal, but also to really help you to be the open arms of the Father, welcoming them back, because sometimes that's not what happens.
That's right.
And so I would pray that would be what's happening. I'll also give you some other references in the show notes, so don't forget that. And let me just say, remember, we always look for an application, a personal application. So don't disappear from listening to this without stopping and saying, God, what are you saying to me through what I've just heard, which is different than we ever talk about in a, as far as the approach, but not in the message. So thank you, Father, for that and for Margaret. And I pray for all of the listeners that they will hear from you what you want to say to them through this. So
Thank you, Lord. Lord, I just
thank
thank you for Judy, and I thank you for her heart to serve all these people and us and me today. And I just ask for your favor. That you would bring all those just that are so beloved home in your perfect time, just in your perfect way.
Thank you, Lord. Your book is available anywhere.
Yeah, there's this wonderful tool now called bookshop.org. So for people who don't like to buy books on Amazon, you can just go to bookshop.org and then your local bookstore will get this book for you. So you can be supporting your local store. If they don't have it in stock, you can still get it through them. And you don't have to be a servant to Amazon if you don't want to be. But yeah, leave a review. Everything is driven by reviews. I mean, it's just amazing how many things now just technologically are impacted by reviews. So even if it's one sentence, just write one sentence. It can be good or bad. The research shows that it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. It just matters that the book is reviewed.
Yeah.
So just please leave a review. And Judy, for your giveaway books, I will definitely sign the books for the people who get them. So just let me know and then I'll
Okay.
send those.
We'll do it.
Great. Thanks a
God bless
lot.
you.
God bless you guys. Thank you
All
so
right.
much.